Hi, everyone. I am Matt Welch. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable Live Webathon Extra YouTube video fundraising annual thingy that we do here at the Reason Roundtable.
That's what we call it. That's the official name.
The old thingy. Can we lose the screen, though, Hunt?
That's what the kids back home really want to hear. It's also, hopefully, we will lose the screen. Whatever. We do a webathon every year, done them for 17 years in a row, where you can give a tax-deductible donation by going to reason.com/webathon. We're on day two here, I think. And let's start, Catherine Mangu Ward, boss lady, by doing a quick round, as all of these rounds will be. Talking in 30 seconds or less, finishing the sentence of you should donate to Reason because...
Thank you for the very enthusiastic TF there, Matt. You should donate to Reason because we do really, really good journalism and we do it from a principled place. And I think that that is this very, very simple answer. We have a lot of people out there in the world doing kind of interesting stuff on the internet, writing the words, making the videos, making the podcasts, making the newsletters. And you have a lot of ideological folk out in the world. Reason really is the place where those two things come together in their best form. Come here for your journalism informed by principle.
32 seconds, you're fired. Peter Suderman.
Your donations help us produce more articles, more videos, more newsletters, and of course, more podcasts. And one of the ways they do that is they help us bring on off-camera and off-mic talent who are absolutely vital to making something like a live pod happen. We have all these folks whose faces and voices you can't see, and they are incredibly important to this process, and your donations make their jobs possible. Also, they make it possible for us to do new stuff that we haven't even done yet, like Reason Versus, which is our upcoming debate series starting in just a couple of weeks at the Howard Theater here in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
He did a couple of real losers in that first debate, though, right?
End of show plug plus end of Monday Night Football season. Thanks to the cameraman there, Nick Gillespie, who I neglected today. America's sweetheart, Nick Gillespie.
Yeah.
People should donate to the Reason Foundation, the 501c3 nonprofit that publishes everything that we do for the reason of.
If you want to live in a future that is more free, more fair, and more fun, fund Reason. We're producing journalism, as other people have mentioned. Last year, we produced two videos a day, released two videos a day, most of them reaching people under the ages of 35, which means we're helping to edify and educate and inspire the leaders of tomorrow. God damn, I wish I'd never invoked that unironically, but it's true. You know, there's right-wing and left-wing populism, pessimism all over the place. Reason is the place that is actually explaining how to make the world better, how to make it more fair, and how to make it more fun. Your money goes directly into all of that.
My reason for the children. My reason is that because Jacob Sullum is a goddamn American hero, and this helps pay his salary. If you're not reading Jacob Sullum during anybody's administration, let alone this incoming one, you are missing out on meticulously crafted and careful and non-hyperbolic and incisive journalism and commentary.
Would it be great if Biden refuses to leave the White House? Because he has no idea where he is. So he's in the incoming administration. It's just, and you know, Hunter doesn't want to go out in that world. He's been out there. It's got nothing for him but Trump.
It's got nothing. I hear that.
His ice cream machine.
Ukraine is nice this time of year.
Take it with him, like Steve Martin and the Jerk.
Certainly, lightning rounds that are loose and fast will not constitute a whole bunch of blather about 1978 cinema. So let's go. We're going to try to get to almost all of your questions, more than our answers, if that makes sense. And we will start with this one from Jamie Lewis to the group, but then we'll go individual, whatever. Blah, blah. Jamie Lewis says, what would you like to see at the top of Congress's agenda for the coming term? I would like to see, Jamie continues, Congress make a detailed review of the American Rescue Plan. Did it meet its stated objectives? Would smaller, more targeted spending achieve the same results? What waste, fraud, or abuse resulted? What could mitigate those results in the future? That's you, Jamie, but you asked us. So, Peter, what would you like to see at the top of the congressional agenda?
So spending cuts, and then probably some more spending cuts. But let's do something specific here. I think that the incoming Congress should go after the Inflation Reduction Act and the spending in the Inflation Reduction Act. It wasn't an inflation bill. It was an industrial policy climate stuff bill. And it was mostly handouts to companies doing green energy. Those things should live and fail based on the market. They should either succeed or fail based on market demand, not on subsidies. And so the spending in the Inflation Reduction Act, which was another one of the follow-up big spending package to the American Rescue Plan, Republicans should look at that and they should zero out as much of it as they possibly can.
Catherine, top of Congress agenda, go.
Yeah, I mean, same vibes, but different tool, I would say. They should just begin the appropriations process. They should just do a whole normal budget process. Peter, what is the relevant budget act you'd like to mention at this time?
The Congressional Budget and Impoundment Act of 1974, which created the Modern Budget Act and the Congressional Budget Office.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. I think that it would be cool if maybe we just started with having Congress use its power of the purse as the good Lord and the founders intended.
Nick.
I want Donald Trump to free Ross Ulbricht day one. This would not only keep a promise that he made at the Libertarian Party convention, which he so far has forgotten that he's attended, but it would also help to legitimate Bitcoin, which is really doesn't need the help, but let's go there. It would also underscore the fact that Trump and HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. are talking about unscheduling things like psychedelics and other currently illicit drugs, as the government calls them. And it would send a shot across the bow to the deep state that we're not going to waste the FBI's time and the surveillance state time going after people who are producing the future of commerce, which is a reputation-rich, violence-free place where you can trade things among consenting adults.
Take a bow, Nick Gillespie, for answering a question about Congress by talking about Trump. I am going to answer the
Congress.
Question by saying
there will be no Congress, Matt. There will be no Congress. Come on. We elected a
Congress,
dictator.
Instead of waiting around for Doge, they should actually do things like overturn the founding acts that created such things as the Department of Education. Yes, you can sort of defund it, but to actually get rid of it, you got to do some legislation. So do that stuff first. All right. Benjamin Stein, no relation. I actually have no idea. Says, if you were setting up a betting pool, what would the over-under be for number of decades until the next national emergency spending event greater than $1 trillion? My answer is decades, dude. But Catherine, what's your answer?
My answer is also decades, dude. I think I give it 3 years.
Yeah, that's where I was going with that. Nick?
It'll by the end of this next fiscal year.
Oh.
What's
a national emergency spending event?
There doesn't have to be anything, but there will be $1 trillion big spending package that goes to the top of the line by the end of this year, because both Democrats and Republicans will want it.
Peter?
So the question was not just $1 trillion big spending package, but emergency spending package. There's almost certainly going to be $1 trillion spending package to go through Congress this year, because that's sort of the way things go every year. And there's reconciliation bills already being teed up for an emergency bill. That's an interesting question. One answer is I would not be setting up a betting pool. So that's not what would happen with me. Another is, what's the next thing that's going to be a big emergency? And if I had to guess, it's going to be a foreign policy crisis. Now, you can't see the next pandemic coming, but it's going to be some sort of foreign policy, foreign entanglement crisis. And so the answer to this question is something like, whenever the next big war thing that happens is that the United States feels like it needs to intervene in. And that could be 18 months from now, and it could be 8 or 10 or 15 years from now.
Maybe you can't see a pandemic, Peter, but you can see a plandemic. This comes from Stephen Schatz. They'll send this to Catherine first for reasons that will soon become obvious. Do you ever read the comments section of the Reason.com articles? If so, any thoughts on them, Catherine?
I do occasionally read the comment section, though I tend to urge young staffers not to do so because the ratios can be a little off if we're looking for helpful versus soul crushing. I am actually more likely these days to read the comments on YouTube on the Reason Roundtable because people are kind of fun in there. So if you want to find me in the comment section, your best bet is probably a YouTube comment section under this very podcast.
Nick, are you still in the game?
I'm in the game, Matt. Yeah. But I remember always that it's just a game. Yeah, I read the comments from time to time, and I'm amazed that, you know, there's some people who were there. I think when we opened up Reason.com, somehow they were there, and they're still lingering. So
I will jump the line by saying I read the comments for the first time in several years yesterday. To answer this question. And I was absolutely tickled pink that Fist of Etiquette still walks among us. I think Fist of Etiquette was commenting before we had a website on in our website comments. Fantastic. Peter, do you read them?
I read your emails, or I try to anyway. And I read many of your tweets, but not the comments.
I stopped because the ratio of usefulness to not usefulness went pear-shaped at some point. However, I did look in the comments, as mentioned, and they were asking questions. They were sometimes on the snarky side, but I thought we'd get to a couple of them. Why not? Gare Grimrud. They still do names
That's
like that,
D&D too. Character's name?
D&D ask a question. Character. Thanks, Peter. Which one is the libertarian? And I think the answer to that, obviously, is it's Catherine, except that Nick thinks he's the one.
Is what
exactly? Don't wake up now. Which one is the libertarian? Is the question, which I think is very funny. Peter and I will be the ones definitely not on the island, and Nick and Catherine can duke it out. But here's one that I would actually like Nick to wake up from his nap to answer. Also in the comments, from Mother's Lament Salt Farmer, the salt farmer in parentheses, is open borders still practicable for a welfare state surrounded by countries without social safety nets, who is giving the noble undocumented $2,000 a month plus free food, clothing, shelter, transgender operations, and Wi-Fi? Yeah.
No, it is true. You get the, you know, you get the transgender operation whether you want it or not.
Yeah.
So it's not always a benefit, but actually, and let's not call it open borders. Let's call it an orderly migration process and procedure. Check people as they come in, make sure that they are who they say they are and that they're not violent felons with you know, transmittable diseases, and keep them out of the welfare till illegal immigrants get less welfare than native-born immigrants take less than native-born. It's easier to process all this and keep it straight if they're actually above board and we know what they're doing. So yeah, I think it is. And it's important not to fall into the trap of saying, oh, you know, well, all of these illegals or legal migrants are getting, you know, tons of money. None of them are coming in order to get a transgender operation. Okay, that's not why you drag your ass from Venezuela through the Mexican desert, you know, and work at an Arby's, you know, on the border between Texas and Mexico.
Let's go to a round of individually directed questions. This one comes from Colton Saunders. For Pytair Suderman says, this question is primary. Suderman, okay. Given the ongoing chartreuse shortage, I'm sorry, this is funny. What do you consider the best substitute, Peter Suderman? Also, what is the libertarian take on the situation? Free market competition will lead to superior herbal liqueurs arising. The monks need to embrace capitalism rather than reject it because that is the best path to improving the world. The French need to stop being so French. Come on, dude. What do you say, Peter Suderman? And let's lament that that Stephanie Slade is not here to answer that question.
Yeah, so this question in many ways would be better directed at Stephanie Slade, who did some of the best journalism about chartreuse ever for Reason Magazine. I would just encourage you to go read her account of the capitalist booze monks, which I think is my take as well on the monks. I think they're great. They're participating in capitalism in a way that I think is mostly wonderful and honorable, making a good thing. And they're deciding how much work they want to do and how much stuff they want to put out into the world. If you're looking for a substitute for chartreuse because you can't find it, the short answer is that the best substitute is a product that is called Genepi de Alpes. It's a herbal liqueur imported by House Alpens. You can also use Strega, and some people like to mix those two things together. That's another sort of pine straw-colored herbal liqueur. In terms of what I think of the shortages, the thing that I think is, it's okay if the monks don't want to make more. They don't have an obligation to make more chartreuse to meet all the demand. The problems that are coming up in terms of getting chartreuse and having access to it are actually mostly about state control. Because if you live in a control state where all of the supply and all the is fixed and controlled by a state apparatus, and all of the prices are also fixed and controlled, so someplace like Virginia or Pennsylvania, you are going to have a very hard time finding chartreuse right now. It's essentially going to be random. And in most cases, you're not going to be able to get it. But if you live someplace like Washington, D.C. or Massachusetts, where I was this summer, where the state does not control supply and prices, you're probably going to be able to find chartreuse. It might not be as easy to find as it was 5 years ago before they limited production, but you're probably going to be able to find it somewhere. It might cost more also, because that's how we deal with limited supply and high demand in a world, is we have prices. And prices can fix these problems. And in fact, over the last couple of years, since chartreuse became limited in supply, at first there was like, oh, everybody just bought up all the chartreuse. It was very hard to find. But now I think it's actually relatively easy to find in these non-control states where there's no price controls, state management of distribution. In fact, over the summer when I was in Massachusetts, I found a store that had like a gigantic rack of chartreuse, and it wasn't even priced very expensively. And so that's that sort of thing I think you're going to see more commonly, but it's mostly going to be determined by the state-based policies on alcohol sales. And the controls and the price controls and the distribution limits that the state puts in place are much more important and are causing much bigger problems than the monks are.
Catherine, this comes from Larry. I want to know what collaborations or project overlap language Reason might have with the Free Press. It seems likely there's a lot of heterodox, sorry, Matt, I hate that word, reader-listener overlap with that media organization. With the recent launch of Reason Versus, it seems like various collaborations, adversarial collaborations or otherwise, might prove interesting, much like ProPublica and the NYT, it's New York Times, collaborate to make big stories possible. Do you plan or foresee any projects where Catherine and Barry hole up in a research hovel or something like that?
I was with you all the way until I was alone in like a yurt with Barry. I'm not saying I wouldn't, but I'm not saying I would. So yes, we already have a lot of overlap. Our Fifth Column friends, the various Reason podcasters and the Free Press tend to end up sometimes all podcasting from the same shoebox at the same time. Yeah. There's a little bit of cross-pollinization there. And Nick and I have both done debates hosted by the Free Press. We assume and hope they will return the favor in our debate series. I also got to just like try to convince the readers of the Free Press that maybe marijuana is cool and should be legal a while back, which was fun. The thing that we have in common absolutely is, again, sorry, Matt, the heterodoxy. The thing we don't have in common, I think, is you know, Reason is and has been forever anchored by its libertarian principles. The Free Press is a little more loosey-goosey. They got some stuff they're really strongly for, and also they got a lot of other kind of chaotic energy there. I think Reason brings the chaos on top of the principle, and I hope you agree, but we absolutely love the Free Press folks.
This comes from Ron, not directed at me, but I'll take it. Hi, I have a question. Wondering why the print magazine has so few advertisements. I understand that print is a difficult business now, but other magazines are still able to fill their pages with ads that help towards the bottom line much more than Reason does. Also, the few ads that are in Reason tend to be for strange offers for collectibles and jewelry. Strange? Jewelry shaming? Are there no mainstream for-profit businesses that would like to have us as customers? Ron, this is what happens in the world of opinion magazines. If you looked at, I don't think The Nation has a lot of glossy, Versace ads in there, and never have. These types of magazines just don't get glossy consumer stuff. And also, I love the weirder the ads, the better. Honestly, it's more fun. And if you look at the back catalog of reasons, some of those ads are particularly fantastic. Catherine, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
I just want to throw in to never forget Reason's classifieds era. Long ago, Reason did personals and classifieds. Some really, really primo stuff back there, all available in our archive, which you could access right now if you were a Reason Plus subscriber.
That's one of the benefits of donating to the Webathon, isn't it?
Hey,
when you go to reason.com/webathon and you donate it, you get that. Also, for those of you watching on this on YouTube, that link is right there in the YouTube description and somewhere else in the thing in the place over there by the corner. Nick, this one comes from either Rashid Benoit or Pat the Goalie. Both of those sound, frankly, like pseudonyms. Question background, Nick tends to bring up his small town residences as a credential. Whenever it's implied he's out of touch with us yokels, I believe an address does not a hillbilly make, and assume he spent most of the time in these places microdosing while musing upon discursive formations. Free me from my unfair estimation. Yeah. Now the actual question, what is the most hick thing routinely enjoyed by Dr. Gillespie? Also adds, please note that I ask this with love, affection, and curiosity. I believe Dr. Gillespie to be a wonderfully odd and insightful person, and he's a big consumer of the Declaration of Independence. So, Nick, what say you?
You know what I love and what I actually miss the most is Walmart, easy access to Walmart. In both the two small towns that I lived in, Huntsville, Texas, and Oxford, Ohio, the Walmart, which was never more than a couple miles away, was the Mecca and the Medina of stuff to do, and just wandering forever the aisles. And I won't get up and empty my closet here, but I have a ton of menswear from the George collection, which is used to be Walmart's house brand, and I love Great Value products. I just tweeted something about, I believe it's called Mountain Thunder, which is their this morning, which is their Mountain Dew knockoff. I love and I miss Walmart, Matt. My kids were visiting for Thanksgiving, and we both talked about that because they live in one lives in Austin and one lives in LA. One has a Walmart nearby, the other has Target, which is objectively a better store, but a little bourgeois for our taste.
This one comes to the group. Dustin James Harper, please give me an example of a protectionist policy that you might be okay with. Is there any industry that is worth using government power to protect? And then he has an analogy about being a chicken farmer that doesn't make any sense to me. So I'm going to let that go. Catherine, you're an anarchist. What protectionist policy do you prefer?
The Catherine Mangu Ward Protection Act of 2025.
It's just for me personally.
No, that's right. There no more offshoring of Catherine Mangu Wards to China.
It is a major problem in our society. I'm going to set aside the anarchist answer for a moment here and say, you know, I guess if we're going to put a restriction on anything, maybe we don't want to sell nukes to other countries or something. I don't know if that even counts, but I grudgingly say that.
Nick, what's your protectionism?
I don't think I really have any. What I'm most interested in is making sure, because it's never about the industry. Industries are small enough where they're not going to be wiped out by, foreign competitors, and then they can get big enough and they'll trade on something else. But what I'm most interested in is making sure that whatever goods are coming in to the country or people, that we have a sense of what's in them. And that's not necessarily something the government has to do for goods.
Inspectors. Nick wants inspectors.
Peter, certification, which can be voluntary. And, I'll accept free trade, fair trade certifications over, USDA pretty much any day of the week.
Peter, do you have any protectionisms?
I mean, like Catherine, nuclear weapons, but no, there's probably some protectionist, reasonable cases for protectionism when it comes to certain types of defense tech. We have AI tools that we use for finding bad guys and targeting or helping with targeting that we probably don't want to just be selling to whoever is willing to to buy it because they're just, it's useful for us. And we probably don't, we probably want to keep that out of the hands of the people who we are trying to track.
Liam Smith asks a series of questions. We might get to two, but let's start with the first one. What do you expect to be the thing about the second Trump presidency that the general public will find most surprising, Nick?
Two things, and I saw that Liam is also in the YouTube comments asking excitedly, wait, did the email questions count too? So Liam, thank you. He's almost certainly watching. I think the big thing that's going to be surprising is that Trump will not be as conservative as his foes fear, and he will be more liberal than his supporters want. So he's not going to cut a lot of spending, but he's also not going to tear up all of the in this house signs across America. He's not going to go after all of that. He will be middling and uninteresting.
Peter, big surprise?
I think people are going to be surprised by the impact of Trump's tariffs, even if they are mostly show tariffs. Even if he does not implement the kind of vast, gigantic, all-around tariffs, not just on China, but on everything that he has sometimes hinted or at or even just explicitly promised. I think people are going to be surprised by the ways that that drives up costs at the grocery store, at Walmart, but also at their businesses. And it's just going to be much more expensive to do almost anything if tariffs along the lines of what Trump has hinted at do go into effect.
Catherine?
I think he might go full Caligula's horse on the Supreme Court. And I think that even though a lot of people are like really ready for the Supreme Court picks to be controversial, they might not be ready enough. I don't know what's going to happen, but I think it's going to be surprising.
Matt Gaetz,
the Supreme Court. I'm calling it now.
I think the biggest surprise will be the recession, which means I'm predicting a recession because most people.
When, Matt? When? That's
second Trump presidency was the parameters of the question. I wasn't asked for a date sometime in the next 4 years or as long as we are graced with his presence.
To draw that back to a previous question, it is possible that we end up in a recession because of tariffs and other poor economic policy decisions. And then that turns out to be the emergency that justifies spending a trillion dollars.
This question is to all of us, but I'm going to address it to Nick because I think it's an aggression towards his very soul. From Michael Murmack, the stated purpose
Murmack.
What?
That bastard.
The subject line is, was C-SPAN a mistake?
Yeah, no. And I actually read his question.
Well, let's read it. Let's share with the class.
All right, go ahead. Maybe, Matt.
Like to the people watching who didn't read it in advance.
Yeah.
The stated purpose of C-SPAN was to use television to help educate and inform the public about how our government operates. Yet, as public intellectuals like Neil Postman have pointed out, moving images more often speak to emotions rather than intellect. We have now seen a television personality rise to the highest office. Worst of all, the first branch of government, Congress, has become far less effective as their members posture for useful video clips during hearings and speeches. Can we ask now, was C-SPAN a mistake? Also, thank you for your fantastic efforts.
Ed Murmack's query, what drove me to the brink of insanity was his invocation of Neil Postman, who's famous for books like Amusing Ourselves to Death, which is an 80s era screed on television news. And the worst part of it is he compares television news to the real stuff, that's happening in places like the New York Times, etc. And later books like Technopoly, which was just a fever dream of somebody who was, in a review of that before Reason, it was actually a review that I used to get the job at Reason. Oh, I referred to Postman as intellectually Amish. He just wanted the world to stop when he kind of felt he was at his peak of understanding things. To bring it back to C-SPAN, and its founder, was one of our 35 Heroes of Freedom, Brian Lamb, and for reasons that are still legit, he turned a surveillance camera on Congress. It's up to us with what we do with it. We're not more stupefied or nihilistic or out to lunch because of C-SPAN. To the extent that people have lost trust and confidence in government, and that might be a precursor to us actually demanding better from them, all hail Brian Lamb and all hail C-SPAN.
Here's a question from Joshua Stack, which I'll direct at Peter. There's been a lot of discussion about ending or peeling back Social Security among libertarian circles. What is the most prudent path forward off-ramp to do so? Some have suggested means testing Social Security, but would this lead to unintended consequences, like people saving less for retirement to qualify for Social Security and added administrative costs of determining need? Chase Oliver, who is the Libertarian Party presidential nominee, proposed abolishing the employee contribution and continuing to fund current retirees and those near retirement with the employer contribution. Is this feasible with the amount of money that would remain in the Social Security fund? Peter?
Well, the main thing is you have to do something. And right now we're planning to do nothing, which is the problem. The Chase Oliver plan, I think, is directionally correct. I'm still in favor of private accounts. The plan that failed under the George W. Bush presidency in the aughts. And if we'd had private accounts since then, people who had invested portions of their Social Security returns in the market would be much better off now than if than they are. And I think that private accounts and private savings and something that that gives people a little bit more personal responsibility and also agency over their retirement is going to be better than the system we have now.
Jonathan has a question about land acknowledgements. Given that indigenous peoples didn't have modern property rights, how does a libertarian think of the dispossession of indigenous land in the United States? At this point, land acknowledgements seem like less like meaningful restitution and more so empty symbolism. Where should libertarians stand on reparative policies like land returns and land acknowledgements? Catherine, I'll give you a swing if you want to take one.
Sure. So two sort of references to start with here. The first is Occasional Reason contributor Amy Sturgis, who is a scholar of Native American property rights and has some pretty interesting stuff to say about all of this. So I recommend her work to you. Also, because you know you girls got to do it, Robert Nozick has some interesting thoughts here, Anarchy State and Utopia. But his other writings as well. It's really, really hard to say... to sort of definitively establish just possession of land. This is not just a problem for Native Americans, but for actually almost all property rights. Somewhere along the line, somebody clubbed something over the head and took it. And so there was not a just transfer of the property right, which can in turn undermine all property rights. It's a hard one. I think that in general, I oppose efforts to resolve this problem by arbitrarily selecting an imagined past point and then also arbitrarily selecting a bunch of descendants of the imagined or real wrongs and handing property over. That is almost certainly going to cause more problems than it solves. But I think it's a reasonable question to ask and explore. And I don't mind if people are like, yeah, I'm sitting here on somebody else's land. If they want to say that at the beginning of a Zoom, so be it.
I think if we violated treaties with existing recognized tribal nations, and we should probably recognize more, I presume, then that's totally open for restitution to those people who still exist. I don't know to what extent all of that is true and actionable, but it's worth thinking about because we treat.
Hey, you know what's good that's related to this question is that people recognize that Andrew Jackson, to name but one American president, but who was the worst in this case, was a complete piece of shit when he just waved away a Supreme Court ruling in favor of the Cherokee people and pushed them west. And I think it's great that to live in an age, even as Trump is once again ascending, that Andrew Jackson is held in lower and lower repute because of his actions. You know, and this doesn't get to the question of land acknowledgments or any kind of payments to ancestors, but recognizing the fundamental injustice of the United States government, just absolutely removing people under circumstances in which it had no authority or moral claim to do so.
I do predict that Trump will end up being a pretty key player in the history of modern history of U.S. government policy towards Native Americans, if nothing else, by having appointed Neil Gorsuch, who really cares about that, and has already done one major Supreme Court decision on this that ended up granting quite a lot of rights to tribal holdings in Oklahoma, among other places. And Trump got, according to exit polls, a pretty huge bump in the Native American vote this time around. Fun fact. Let's skip over the libertarian poser's landmine for a second here and go down to, oh, there's another one. This always gets asked. So Josiah, Ham, come on down. I've got a short question. In which cases should intellectual property be subject to property rights, Nick?
Rarely. This is an issue that is starting to become interesting again, but we wrote a lot about this towards the end of the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s. But clearly, copyright in its original constitutional iteration was not that big a deal because it was an actual limited time in which the creator of something or the owner of the copyright had a monopoly to the profits from it, something similar with patent. Patent laws haven't been abused as much, but I'm willing to live with a created fictional property right for a short period of time. I don't think it's necessary in most cases. We did great work on things like fashion and cuisine, where there's a massive amount of innovation and progress without any kind of real property rights, which is the explicit reason for intellectual property rights in the Constitution. So I hope that answers. So little and less for shorter periods of time.
This one I'll direct to Catherine from Dan Disidorio. My wife and I attended private school in Massachusetts, and it's where we met. I have three kids of my own, and they currently go to public school. So you just jerked that ladder right up after you, didn't you? I believe in the idea of public school because you interact with kids from all walks of life. Massachusetts has pretty good public schools, but we recently eliminated the standardized test for that all 10th graders needed to pass to graduate. So it seems like we're lowering our standards. Additionally, some towns have seen an influx of migrants arriving, which has caused us to focus resources on kids who speak little to no English. Additionally, since COVID, it seems that a bunch of kids have lost the ability to control their behavior. So teachers spend a lot of time dealing with behavioral kid problems. Should I stop believing in the idea of public schools and realize the reality is that average kids just won't get a lot of attention? I have fond memories of my school years, and I'm wondering if public school can do the same for my kids. What say you all, Catherine?
Yeah, I have tried over the years to be more generous to when people say, I believe in public schools or I believe in the idea of public schools. That is not intuitive to me because there's nothing special about dumping all the children from a geographical area into the same building to like make America a good place. And that is at the very root what public schools are. And I think, you know, if I'm reading that charitably, what I hear is I would like to live in a country where people of different backgrounds and social classes interact as children and where we have institutions that bring our communities together, ideally in some kind of shared physical space. And those two goals, I think, make a lot of sense. I don't think there's any strong reason to vest that all in the same institution that's supposed to be like teaching my kid how to read. My kids go to private school now. They did go to public school before. They may go to public school again. And I was at public school all the way through. Having sampled all of the above, I think it is so much more about people's specific circumstances than it is about the idea or the principle of public school. And also that private schools can and do serve those functions all the time. They do bring people together. They do serve as a kind of, you know, a place where people of different backgrounds can overlap. And there are lots of private schools that prioritize that. So maybe what you want is a not snooty private school. Maybe what you want is a parochial school. A lot of Catholic schools do that, by the way. Yes, you have to have the Catholic part in there, which is not my fave, but for some people, that's not a problem. So I would say the things you like about public schools can and almost certainly are being performed by other types of schools better.
An underrated concept of public policy right now is that we have already passed and are probably never going to go back there again. Peak public school, not just in percentage, but in raw numbers of Americans with their kids in public schools and especially in government managed public schools as opposed to charters. That number peaked before COVID. 2019, I think, is the number I wrote about this a little while ago. And that has just vast implications for public policy, given that 25% of state and local budgets are in that direction. This is a question to the group, but for reasons that will probably become clear, I'm going to direct it at Peter Suderman. It's from Leonard Goodnight. Hello. If the reason editorial staff were a United Federation of Planets Starship command crew, which of you would hold which position on the bridge and or engineering, etc.? Please feel free to include some guest stars. Go wild. Peter, I'm giving you this and a time clock. Go.
What's the time? So like an hour? Yeah. Like several hours here, we've got plenty of time. So obviously, I sit in the Riker chair, not only because of the beard, but basically because that's the role I play. And while I didn't play the trombone very much, I played the tuba. It's pretty similar. So I think Catherine just has to sit in the captain's chair. She makes the calls. She makes the decisions. She says, "Make it so." She kind of pulls her shirt down, just like it's very very similar to the whole. Patrick Swayze.
Patrick Swayze pulled his shirt down in an extremely different way.
He just ripped it off. Yeah. Really.
I think Nick's role is as Guinan. He is our Whoopi Goldberg figure, right? Like, at this point, like on the one hand, you don't see
sexually him too. Yeah.
You don't see him on the deck of the ship very often. But when people in command have a really tough problem, they go to Guinan to like talk it out and have a drink and, you know, sort of like stare out the port window of 10 forward. And what is Matt Welch? What are we going to do with Matt Welch? I think we're going to stick Matt Welch in the engine room and just hope that the dilithium crystals keep working. Even though Matt has absolutely, like, of the four of us, the least amount of technical skill, there's something about, like, Matt's off in the other room and you really only communicate with him via, like, the thing on your chair, the button on your chair that, like, allows you to talk to engineering. And you call him and you say, "How bad are things?" And he says, "Decks 34 through 37. It's just a total train wreck. But in 4 hours, it's going to be fixed." And then it's not fixed in 4 hours. But 6 hours later, it's basically fine.
More esoterica. Jonathan Gress asks, occasionally I hear Nick mention the English Civil War and would be curious to hear more of his thoughts on the matter. Was Cromwell's victory good for freedom? Did it inspire the American Revolution in any way? In England, it's traditionally seen as a strange and best forgotten aberration, but even in America, it's barely taught, even though it forms the backdrop of both the Puritan settlement of New England and the settlement of the coastal South by exiled royalists. Should more Americans know about it?
Yes, absolutely. And Cromwell's victory was very important both to the United States, but also ultimately to a liberal constrained government. Cromwell's reign was a disaster. And that's the thing to keep in mind. But Cromwell helped get rid of unlimited monarchy in England. And I think more people should know about this, not only because he is the best case scenario of a country that is beset with a tyrannical monarch who may or may not care about limits on his power. But you get rid of him. And then you buy somebody who promises you more freedom and more choice, and then becomes as bad or worse as that person. This is something that we see again and again in world history. And Cromwell is in many ways the most interesting and best instantiation of that. The thing to take away from the English Civil War period are two main lessons. One is technological. It was basically underwritten by an explosion of printing presses that could not be regulated. That could be moved around and hidden, and people started just literally printing tens of thousands of pamphlets explaining why this is the way the world should be. And that is just a wonderful and beautiful thing, also disruptive, but definitely freeing. And then the other thing is the group of people who got literally chased out of and hunted down and killed by Cromwell after they helped him defeat the monarchy is the group, the Levellers, who are very much proto-libertarians who believed in equality under the law, egalitarianism, property rights, and things like that. We would do so much better to recover the history of the English Civil War, which was very much on the minds of the founding fathers.
Zach Galleon asks me a question. Welch, as I've seen your recent references, that you are a relatively newly minted Johnny Blue Skies fan. That's the gnome to whatever of Sturgill Simpson. Please provide your definitive catalog rankings and a brief word as to why. No, sir, I will not. I rarely do that with the bands that I've been listening to for 55 years. So I've been listening to old Sturge for about 3 months. His first couple records are great. big straight ahead country boy attack. The Sound and Fury record is just like weird sleazy synth, and I'm wrapping my head around it. And the last one, Passage du Désir, is probably the one I've listened to most, just because it came out this year, and there's some pretty lacerating business on it. So I'm still wrapping my head around the whole thing. Ask me again in 55 or so,
Matt. But could you? Which one of us is which Beach Boy from the classic lineup? I know you want to.
Nope. Not
who is Al Jardine? That's the essential question.
I'm too close to the story.
You can't hurt my feelings because I won't know what you say. So carry on.
That is true. We don't allow ladies. Speaking of ladies, Luke has a question. That's good for you. Is there a libertarian case against billionaires?
Good question.
Are they even possible in a world without crony capitalism, subsidies, and government granted monopolies? Catherine. Yeah.
First, I just want to return to a previous question and say we are absolutely not letting Matt get anywhere near the dilithium crystals, and he's Diana Troy, just to be clear. Okay. Second, yes. So I think you can absolutely make a taxonomy of billionaires, and there are good ones and bad ones. It's pretty easy, actually. The good ones are the ones that got their money because people gave it to them voluntarily. Now, there are, of course, always going to be statist shades of gray in all transactions in a society with government. But in general, if you invent like a whole new thing, like, I don't know, Amazon or something, and then everyone gives you their money to use the thing you invented, that's a good billionaire. If you, I don't know, find a bunch of oil in the ground and convince the government of the place that has that oil to just let you extract it and sell it for your own personal gain, that's a bad billionaire. That's a bad one. We don't like those kinds. And then you have to kind of just do the math in between. And I think that it's totally right to always be asking the question, how much of this person's wealth is a result of state action, and be sort of skeptical. I follow, among others, Ayn Rand in noticing that markets do not reward virtue. They are not, it's not the same thing to be successful in the market as it is to be good, but it is at least a closer proxy than being successful in extortion and extraction.
This is one for all of us that maybe we'd like to hear from all of us on, from DJ Waldo. I hope that's a nom de plume, but either way, it's fantastic. For a $25 donation, my question is, has a cultural recommendation ever changed your opinion on a big issue that you had? Peter, why don't you lead us off? Can you think of that ever happening?
Oh, man, that's a really good question.
Maybe it's best to recast, and like, has a piece of culture, not necessarily a recommendation, but just something that you've consumed, novel, movie, whatever, television show, changed your idea about a policy?
I am struggling to think of an instance in which that has happened. There have definitely, and I'm still struggling to think of a specific example, but there have definitely been instances in which a piece of art, a movie, a book, or something like that has helped shape my understanding, given me a sort of a metaphor or a reference point, so I can sort of think about something more clearly. But I don't know that there's ever been one that just flat out changed my mind about a public policy issue.
Nick, which Beach Boys record made you believe that Charles Manson was actually good?
Interestingly, Matt, I went down a lo-fi Beach Boys mid-60s wormhole not long ago. Yeah. So I was listening to Smiley Smile and Wild Honey and whatnot.
I mean, that should have scared you off of drug legalization once and for all.
Well, yeah, you know, but it's kind of like, it actually is more of a challenge. Like, what are the drugs that would snap them back into musical competency? I don't know.
Those are great works of art. I will brook no dissent.
They really are. Yeah, and they make me hate the Beach Boys a little bit less. And having said all of that, I don't know off the top of my head. It's a great question, and I wish I had thought about it for days beforehand to see that. Because right now I'm drawing a blank.
Catherine, anything?
You know, the thing I can come the closest to is that show Upload, which, I generally am in favor of all kind of futuristic interventions, especially ones that promise immortality. But I felt like that show gave me some pause on maybe what our balance should be as a society of wanting to do that particular subvariant of a thing. I don't know if that's enough of like a public policy implication exactly. I think it could just as easily be a cultural one, but like, should we be gearing our general societal resources toward uploading our brains? Maybe we should look into some other options, was the thing I came down after watching that show.
But that show kind of took for granted that we would be. And then it's really like, do you want to be in the shareware version or do you want to pay for the monthly subscription, right?
Yeah, I just think it painted for me a fuller portrait of what some of that might look like. And I had not thought about it deeply beforehand.
There's a fantastic subplot in one of the Ian M. Banks science fiction books from the Culture series. And these take place in a post-singularity future in which essentially all technology is possible. And so, of course, you can have things like uploading yourself, but then copying yourself living in a fully created virtual world. And so there is one society that he writes about that is an intensely religious authoritarian society. And so they use this technology essentially to create hell. And then because their religion says that hell has to exist. And so they use it to create a hell and to send people's uploaded versions of themselves into this hell, because of course the spiritual hell, well, they can't find any evidence that it's real, but they can make this one real. And it's a kind of terrifying vision of what you can do with technology like that.
I have two kind of answers. One is that just the one scene in A Wrinkle in Time when all the kids like walk out, from the book. I haven't seen the movie. When they bounced the ball once, instilled me with a horror of conformity, like workaday totalitarianism that has never worn off. I can see that. I'm shuddering just thinking about it. And the other thing, around the same time of my childhood, I was influenced by what is perhaps the most of my generation influential piece of art on public policy, and that was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Which both the movie, which is the first thing that I fell under the spell of, and then also the book, convinced a lot of people that institutionalization and shock therapy was terrible on mental patients. And so after that, there was a great deinstitutionalization that many people point directly to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Matt, you're historically wrong about that, but go ahead.
Am I?
Yeah. Yeah, the movie version in particular, which came out in like 75, that was at the end of that period. The novel, you have a better case to make. And it also becomes very interesting because one of the big reveals, spoiler alert, is that most of the people are there voluntarily.
Voluntarily, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Thinking about it just for just another minute, I think the Blues Brothers might have had an influence on me, because even before I was thought of myself as a libertarian or a free market guy or somebody who cared about bureaucracy, it really helped me understand that Chicago's municipal governance was garbage. Just hilarious, hilarious, inefficient garbage, even back in the 1980s. And as far as I can tell, that's still true today.
Kevin Weiss has some practical advice. Question. I sometimes dream about being a writer or vlogger. What is your advice on a practical day-to-day level? I ask about the day-to-day because after my family Thanksgiving party on Saturday, my wife and I took some edibles. This is going straight to Nick, and talked a bit about how I want to write more and eventually work at somewhere like Illinois Policy Institute. Wow. Yeah. It's all coming together. Yeah. I suddenly remembered that part of what made Vivaldi great was the sheer volume of music he created meant that he had many duds, but also a few significant hits. Is that how writing is, or at least how it is when trying to get your foot in the door? I'm in my mid-30s and a high school English teacher. Has the ship sailed? And should I stop dreaming? Or are there some practical steps I can take?
Yes, stop dreaming. You know, that way madness lies. Now, to paraphrase and misquote Gary Gilmore, just do it, right? Now, you know what? My advice to him, especially if he's an English teacher, he's probably a pretty good reader and writer and things like that. And also places like the Illinois Policy Institute are always looking for capable people with, you know, engagement and understanding of facts on the ground. We live in a world, if 17th century England was a place where people could voice their opinions in print for the first time, And then if they got caught, you know, if people found out who they were, they might kill them. It's so much easier now. Start a Substack, start a YouTube channel, do whatever you want. Start speaking and cultivating a public. It's easier now than ever. It's also easier now than ever for people to ignore you. But if you're putting out good stuff, it's going to get noticed. It's never too late.
It's never too late. Amen to that.
Please.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, Catherine, I didn't hear.
Can I also answer, please?
Yes, please.
Just because I love this question so much. Your wife seems cool, so hopefully she'll be cool with you making less money for a minute. That's what you should actually do, is you should figure out how to be cool with that. And then you should send a clip of this YouTube to the Illinois folks and say, I want to work for you guys. And I bet they'll hire you maybe. And also maybe you should send me a pitch. Just saying.
Oh, wow.
Just saying it.
Wow. That's I get your foot in the door here. At the risk of French goodbying, I wanted to read this one from our friend, Andy Hawks, directed at Catherine first. Dear Roundtable, I could not vote for Chase Oliver, largely because of his disdain for the non-aggression principle in regard to American support for Israel and Ukraine. You're welcome, Catherine. The NAP is clearly embodied in the UN Charter in both Article 2, parentheses 4, which prohibits the threat or use of force against another state's territorial integrity or political independence, and Article 51, which reaffirms the inherent right of individual and collective self-defense against an armed attack. I will stipulate that deciding when and where to enforce the NAP is governed by prudential considerations. But given this stipulation, how should the NAP be viewed in terms of American foreign policy? Andy also listed a bunch of other stuff to think about. But let's just start with there, Catherine. Do we nap foreign policy?
Hi, Andy. Happy to hear from you. I have never been a non-aggression principle girl, just in the sense of like, it doesn't feel useful to me as an ordering principle or as a way to answer hard questions for precisely this reason. It seems to me that the answer to this question hinges entirely on just the sort of very specific practical applications of a whole bunch of libertarian values, including the right to self-defense. And that this is a math problem, not a moral problem in a lot of ways. So I think that's often the case when people invoke the NAP. They're like, NAP says, and it's like NAP says a lot of things, depending on how you interpret it. So maybe that's not the place to start in answering this question.
I think just that similarly, except way more than Catherine, I don't wake up in the morning and think about the NAP. But the issue of territorial integrity and countries aggressing and seizing territory from other countries, that's just the basic of international relations for centuries. And that principle, when it's violated, is very serious, and one should formulate seriousness in response to that. Doesn't mean I'm telling you exactly what U.S. should be doing and not doing in Ukraine and Israel in that matter. But I will remind one and all that, there was a great joint speech given by George H.W. Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev in 1990, saying that the international order cannot stand seeing, in this case, Iraq try to swallow up one of its neighbors. And that it's important even for these two old adversaries, the U.S. and the USSR, to get together and to jointly condemn and do something about this violation of international sovereignty. And then in order to really seal the deal and win a devotion to that principle from the new from that point onward, they christened this the New World Order. So that didn't maybe work out, but there's something to that that line of thinking that is good. Nick and Peter, do you want to add to anything, or shall I move to our closing arguments?
Just very quickly, thank you for invoking that moment, Matt, because that Iraq invasion was questionable. I'd say the invasion that George W. Bush did, which he did without really getting any kind of buy-in from anybody else in the region, et cetera, it showcases what Catherine was getting at, which is that there is not a single axiom that is going to determine any action in any given moment. And, even in the current moment when we're talking about Ukraine and we're talking about Israel and America's role in either supporting, not supporting, brokering, peace in those places. It varies, both because we have actual alliances with some and not with others. There are, you know, a lot of different factors. And I think that foreign policy, even more than domestic policy, needs to be governed by really serious thought about the particulars of a given place and not a kind of dogmatic axiom that may or may not make any sense in the long or the short run.
At times there have been libertarian things like the whole, like, who've tried to boil libertarianism down to two words, anything peaceful. And I think that there's limits to that phrase, right? It doesn't give you an answer in every circumstance. And certainly in Israel, with what's going on, like, that's not necessarily like, oh, that just tells you what we should do. At the same time, if you start from those two words, anything peaceful, that's what we're for, then that goes a long way towards helping people understand, especially in the domestic sphere, what's okay, what's good, what we support, and what kind of world we're looking for.
We are right at the 1 hour mark. So I want to be dogmatic and disciplined by closing us up here. Thank you all to who have been watching this whole time. If you are new to us and wondering what the hell this is all about, go to reason.com/podcasts. All of our podcasts are there, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, the Reason Roundtable, Just Asking Questions with Zach Weissmuller and Liz Wolf, and plenty of others besides. We're here for the Webathon, our annual fundraising event, to give money to the nonprofit that makes our work possible. Go to reason.com/webathon to start mashing all kinds of buttons there to help us along. Catherine, do you want to give a valedictory? Is that the right word? Probably not. Mm-hmm. A closing idea of what are some stuffs that donators to Reason can expect from the mothership here over the next 12 months. What are we using that money for besides Nick's drug habit?
We are always trying cool new stuff. We have recently launched a whole bunch of newsletters. If you want to learn about sex and technology, we have Elizabeth Nolan Brown. If you think actually every single public policy issue comes down to zoning, Christian Britschke is your guy. We have Free Media, which is both a YouTube show and a newsletter featuring Robbie Suave, who will tell you about why censorship is bad and also the media is kind of bad. We have a bunch more of these coming down the line, including some that I would not even dare to tout because people are going to be so excited about them until I'm sure they're going to happen. We are also
Trumpian of you, by the way.
A whole bunch. Yeah, some people are saying there are good newsletters coming down the line. We have a whole bunch of new YouTube channels jumping out from our main YouTube channel so that you can get exactly what you want. Comedy, blather, news, whatever you want. We have it for you. We've got some exciting investigative stories that take a really long time and are really expensive to put together. And your donations support all of that.
We come out every Monday, this podcast does, and stay tuned for more Webathon-related content coming up over the next several days as we put this annual exercise to bed. Thanks again for watching, and we will catch you all soon. Goodbye.